Previously on Accused.
I remember it vividly. And he was dressed in a hoodie. He had a hoodie on, like a sweatsuit outfit.
What are you talking about? How can I confess anything to someone I don't know anything about?
It was shocking to me as an attorney that there wasn't a mistrial.
I'm Amber Hunt, and this is Accused, the unsolved murder of Reetha Welch. William Virgil was convicted in part because of testimony by a man who lied on the stand. It took some time, but Virgil proved it. Joe Womack had straight-up lied about the two sharing an isolation cell. This is where the case takes a turn. While it's nothing new for a jailhouse informant to give false testimony, Innocence Project lawyer Elliot Slosar says he's never seen anything quite like what happened in this case. In a court hearing, he used words like railroaded and framed as he accused the police of misconduct.
The truth is on our side, and frankly, the egregious police misconduct that happened here that led to William spending 3 decades wrongfully in prison, we've already revealed that.
He isn't showboating. He believes this. Because he's talked to Joe Womack, who told him a tale of corruption that he's never heard before.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
William Virgil wasn't the type to sit quietly in prison. He filed lawsuits and motions on his own behalf. He read law books and helped other prisoners with their petitions. After he successfully backed the courts into acknowledging that inmates in isolation weren't allowed cellmates, he thought he had sucker-punched the system. He thought he would soon be free. That was 1991. Soon after, Virgil filed a petition that alleged he had been convicted because of perjured testimony and that he'd been denied a fair trial. He wrote that his conviction should be vacated or reversed. He lost that battle in circuit court. In 2004, the matter was finally settled by the state appellate court, which, in an unpublished opinion, determined that, quote, questions surrounding Womack's testimony have been resolved previously during this litigation. Thus, there is no actual controversy to be resolved. Therefore, the circuit court correctly determined Virgil may not seek relief, end quote. Later, during a court hearing in this case, Circuit Judge Fred Stein would talk about how this decision had been reached by the higher court.
The phrasing that he, they found he'd perjured himself at trial or he was a perjurious witness, gives the impression that, you know, nothing he said was true. And I always wondered, looking at the facts of this case, well, if that is the case, how in the world did they not reverse it on an 1142? Well, I found out when I went upstairs and read the entire volume that discussed that. It's because they were in adjoining cells because they were in solitary at the same time. That's what it was, and this was simply a point of impeachment.
Virgil's lawyer, Linda Smith, didn't entirely buy that argument. She told the judge at that same hearing...
Well, I think that further clarification may prove necessary. My understanding of that solitary space is you're behind solid doors.
And you may
so there was no way, unless there was shouting going on, in which case I think everybody on that cell block would have come forward to say they wanted to testify on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Law professor Colin Miller of the University of South Carolina's School of Law says he doesn't know how much the specifics of the perjury would have mattered to jurors. They might have reasoned that just because Womack lied about sharing a cell didn't mean he lied about what Virgil told him. What Womack said on the stand was so specific, Miller reasons, jurors might have convicted Virgil even if they had learned before the trial's end that he had lied about where it happened.
So when you read Joe Womack's testimony to the jury, did that seem credible to you? Would that have seemed something that a jury would embrace?
I think so, because looking through the testimony and comparing it to the crime scene and what we know about the crime, he gave fairly specific details about the murder and then placing the victim in the bathtub, the ditching of the Cadillac. So you look at it and say, as opposed to an informant who gives very vague testimony, the defendant confessed, this person had very detailed information about the crime that if I'm a juror, I likely would look at it and say, this is someone who's guilty because this person is giving a fairly detailed accounting of what he had to say.
So where would Womack have gotten the details? That would take a while longer to figure out, but here we go. Virgil had been slapped down in appeals, but he kept fighting. He wrote to an Innocence Project in New York, hoping someone would intervene on his behalf. Eventually, an Innocence Project formed in Kentucky, and it got hold of the case. Through that project, a lawyer named Linda A. Smith and an investigator named James Dudley started digging into the case surrounding Retha Welch's murder. Dudley goes by the nickname Jimmer. Normally, I call people by their last names, but I cannot resist this nickname. After years of research, Jimmer and Elliot Slosar were connected, and they decided to ask Womack some questions. So they headed to the northeasternmost tip of Ohio and asked if Womack was willing to talk. It was about more than sharing a cell. Womack's testimony was so effective because it was incredibly specific. When he testified before a grand jury, he remembered Retha's whole name. He knew she was a minister, and he said Virgil had stolen her car, a pink Cadillac, and dumped it in the nearby city of Covington, Kentucky. Retha's car, indeed, was found in Covington the day after her body was discovered. Womack knew Retha had been bashed in the head and stabbed more than 20 times. He knew about bloody footprints. The Innocence Project investigators didn't know how he got all those details, but they didn't think they came from Virgil. That's why they wanted to talk to Womack.
We went in there thinking that he was going to be a tough cookie.
That's Jimmer talking with lawyer Linda Smith. It turned out Womack didn't put up the expected tough front. He seemed eager to talk, in fact.
Yeah, it was just amazing, the information that he provided.
Well, we've had snitch testimony in other cases that has fallen apart, too. So, I mean, the fact that he wasn't honest was not surprising, but the part about how orchestrated it was.
Here's what Womack told Jimmer and Slosar had really happened. He was a 23-year-old prisoner in Lebanon when he met Virgil there. It was Womack's first prison stint. He was hundreds of miles away from his family. He and Virgil were placed in adjacent cells in August 1987. Virgil was so upset that Womack at some point told him to calm down. That's when Virgil mentioned he had a detainer from Kentucky. Virgil started to explain what the detainer was about, but he was cut short. He did manage to say he was innocent. Womack, in a written statement for Slosar and Jimmer, said, quote, "I recall a guard by the name of Cox getting William from his cell. Cox was taunting William about the Kentucky case. At one point, William got uppity when he responded to Cox. Cox was livid. Cox was so upset he put William back in his cell," end quote. Soon after, Cox came to Womack's cell and said he had heard him talking to Virgil about the murder. Womack claims that Cox threatened him. "Either tell me what you two were talking about, or you'll be charged with a murder." Womack balked. "He didn't tell me anything," he said. "He only told me what his detainer was about." Within a week, Womack said he was summoned to the office of a deputy superintendent named Campbell. Womack again said he didn't know anything. He was put in the hole for 15 days. Womack wrote that a correctional officer, quote, "took me out of my cell and took me to Campbell's office. The shackles were tight, and I stood there for 2 hours," end quote. When Campbell finally spoke to him, he said, "Do you remember now?" Then he showed Womack a photograph of a white woman and asked, "Did he tell you how many times he stabbed her?" Womack said he was starting to get the picture. Later, he was called back into Campbell's office to chat with a detective. Womack wrote, "The detective made it clear to me that he wanted me to lie and say that William confessed to the murder." Womack obliged. He wrote a 3-page statement on September 28, 1987, that he now says was filled with information pre-fed to him. The statement was tape-recorded, he said, but the detective didn't turn on the recorder until after they had gone over the details. Womack said he knew nothing of the specifics in Aretha's murder until the detective told him what to say. Quote, "The detective told me that if I gave a statement and later testified falsely that William confessed to me, that he would get me out of prison," end quote. As Slosar and Jimmer listened to this tale, they kept a guard up. It's tough to know how much to believe when you're listening to a confessed liar. They matched up some details, the names Cox and Campbell checked out, for example, and they started to feel comfortable that what they were hearing was the truth. But the orchestration didn't stop there. This is the part that floors Slosar. Womack said he eventually was transported to Newport to testify before a grand jury. A couple of detectives gave him cash and made sure he was comfortable. Then they gave him a transcription of his earlier recorded statement and told him they would be back to help him remember things. Quote, "These officers rehearsed the false story with me and were telling me what they wanted me to testify about at the grand jury," end quote. The next day, Womack said he saw the assistant prosecutor handling Virgil's case, who asked if he had been doing his homework, studying the statement he was to give. Then detectives gave him a cheat sheet to study so that he would, quote, "be ready for my quiz," end quote. The sheet included details about the murder that the officers wanted me to falsely testify to, end quote. Womack's updated statement for Jimmer and Slosar goes on for 12 pages. We'll post it online at accusedpodcast.com so you can read it in full. Here are a few direct quotes from that statement that I want to highlight before moving on. "To be perfectly clear, I lied when I said we shared cells. I lied when I stated that William Virgil confessed to killing Aretha Welch. I took the cheat sheet and my recorded statement back to the jail. The cops gave me a carton of cigarettes when dropping me off. When I got the answers wrong, one detective got really angry at me because I didn't have his cheat sheet memorized. He threatened me. He went on a verbal tirade before leaving. When the assistant prosecutor came in, he told me how thankful he was that I was helping Hoot get his career back on track after being an alcoholic." That last quote refers to C. Houston Ebert, the head prosecutor in the case. Before Virgil's lawyers interviewed Womack, their estimation of him wasn't forgiving.
"The two snitches that talked to him, the one has been exclusively shown to have been, you know, a big, fat, hairy liar."
That was Linda Smith in 2011. After she and Jimmer heard Womack's side of things several years later, their opinion changed.
You know, because we understand where Womack was coming from at the time. You know, he was a young kid and incarcerated the first time, and that he was going to get some help. Being a black male at that time, you know, with white prison guards, and there's a lot of factors for him to do what he did. And I get it.
When he was telling you what he says now happened, is he remorseful about the testimony that landed somebody in, you know,
very
prison?
Much so, very much so. And, you know, and I think in the course since that time that it's really ate at him and made him make other life choices that affected him worse because of this weight that was on his shoulders. You know, and I think he told us that if I ever had the opportunity to make it right, I would. And he did, and he held true to that by saying what he said.
Womack's testimony, without question, was key in convicting William Virgil, and he said he was rewarded. Prosecutor Ebert wrote letters on his behalf, and Womack was released from prison after serving the minimum of the 5 to 25 years he had been sentenced for aggravated burglary. Womack, "My belief is that the letters resulted in my early release from prison. end quote. The whole ordeal is emblematic of the issues that arise when using jailhouse informants, says Robert Patton, Virgil's original defense lawyer.
I'll tell you, if anybody's listening to this podcast or whatever, do not believe somebody who is in jail who said your client or my client confessed to them. Now, a lot of people think that they can get, they have nothing to do, so they'll sit around. Eventually, they'll start talking about how they bump somebody off to make everybody think that they're really important and one tough-ass guy. And maybe that could have happened, but you can, you know, it just doesn't happen that often.
It's one thing to make up a story. It's another to allege that police fed you the story to begin with. Here's me talking with Alexandra Natapoff, the University of California Irvine law professor who wrote a book on snitching.
In this particular case, the informant now says that he not only made up what he said, but that police fed him that information right down to giving him a cheat sheet to memorize, and he was reprimanded when he didn't memorize it properly. It's my understanding that that's a little above and beyond what we normally see, right? Police giving cheat sheets. I mean, and I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying that allegation.
I understand.
Yeah.
So when it comes to informants, fact is always stranger than fiction. And I've been doing this a long time, and I am still surprised at the things that occur in the shadowy world of informant deals. We have seen... grand juries have documented cases in which police feed information to their informants to improve their testimony, to improve their credibility in order to strengthen the case. Back in the early 1990s, there was an enormous jailhouse snitch scandal in Los Angeles County. Hundreds of cases were overturned. A grand jury was convened to examine the use and abuse of jailhouse snitches in the Los Angeles County Jail, one of the largest jails in the country. And one of the things that the grand jury concluded after its enormous investigation with dozens of witnesses and thousands of pages of documents is that the sheriff's department and law enforcement would give information to their informants from the file, or show informants information from the file, in order to bolster their testimony and strengthen their cases. And we've seen this elsewhere. So even though it seems shocking and backwards, we think that the government is using informants in order to obtain information, but in fact, we see sometimes that the government uses informants to bolster what it believes to be the correct outcome in that case.
Both Slosar and Jimmer say Womack seems genuinely remorseful. For his part, Womack said detectives from Kentucky began asking to speak again after he gave his new statement. Womack refused to meet with them because, he said, he wasn't going to be bullied into lying about William Virgil again.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
Let's go back again for just a minute to the trial. Virgil's cross-examining Womack was a dramatic scene, one that his defense lawyer said might have turned jurors against him. He was combative. He was mouthy. He kept repeating himself. He was admonished by the judge a couple of times for saying outright that Womack was lying. Even if only a fraction of what Womack now says is true, it all makes a bit more sense. Here, Amanda and I are talking about it with Elliot Slosar, one of the current defense lawyers.
I have to tell you, there are two parts of this case that reading from today's perspective really stood out to me. One was the shoes. They came in and Brandt asked to look at one of his shoes, and it's from reading it, it appears that Virgil said, okay, you can look at a shoe. And then he's like, oh, this looks like it matches, and so I'm taking both your shoes. And then that's used against Virgil because Virgil is like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, you're taking his shoes.
Yeah.
Like, of course he's yelling at you.
Yeah.
You're literally taking the shoes off
totally.
His feet. And then the other one was the cross-examination of Womack, because that, again, if you're looking at it like he's guilty, he looks a little unhinged, and maybe it's a bad idea, and maybe he's confrontational. If you look at it through the prism of maybe he's innocent, of course you would do that. Of
yeah.
course you would challenge that guy. So it's really interesting to see it from this vantage point.
It's funny, because one of the conversations we had early on when I was... in the process of jumping onto this case was, William, at trial, you're going to have a group of attorneys there, including me. And at no point do I ever want you to be cross-examining the witnesses, through the pretrial experience, William, trusted us, and he knew that we were doing what was in his best interest, and that we knew the record well, and that we were developing a record that had never been unraveled before.
He didn't have that trust with his initial lawyers, you think?
I mean, I think it was different. He knew that he was being framed for a murder that he didn't commit. He knew that Joe Womack was lying. He didn't think that, his attorney was doing the best job. He asked some questions, and I think that, all of my wrongfully convicted clients at their trials would have wanted to ask those same questions.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it helped him, but at least, he was able to spend the last three decades knowing that he did everything that he could at the original trial to save himself.
I mean, there is that he's not sitting there going, I should have said something.
Exactly.
Not that Virgil doesn't have regrets. He wanted to testify in trial, but Patton advised against it, and Virgil acquiesced.
So I very seldom advise they testify unless, one, they're really, really clean, and two, they can speak the language the way they need to, and they can communicate with old folks who are going to be on your jury. Most of the time, they're over 50.
Right.
And
well, there's a reason that most defense lawyers don't put on their witness,
right.
clients, right?
That's right. And any little mistake... you like see it on all TV shows, and I didn't mean to kill her, or something like that comes out, and okay, good. You don't want to say that in front of a jury, and you might be found negligent if you put on your client on some cases, and you should have known better. So,
do you remember if he wanted to testify?
Yeah, he did, but there wasn't anything he could say except he thinks he might have been, he didn't have a house, but he didn't know where he was at that time. And that's all he could have said concerning that. And like I said, the fact that she was no angel, as the paper made her out to be, that was irrelevant. And certainly the fact that these days, at least in those days, in the 80s and so on, some woman having a boyfriend who's black was not common. And the jurors are, you always figure they're 10 or 15 years behind the times, most of the time. You don't get hip young people on a jury. You get a lot of middle-aged business folks and old retired folks.
As Patton talks about speaking the language and talking clean, it's arguably worth reminding listeners that Virgil was a black defendant being judged by an all-white jury. As Virgil remembers...
They had one black person on the pool. They didn't even call them up. Didn't ask a question or not.
The entire jury was white.
Yeah.
In light of Womack's new statement, Slosar doesn't trust any of the statements gathered by the detectives in this case. Unfortunately, he's not able to reach out to some of the witnesses who gave them because they're dead. He wonders, for example, if Sue Daniel was coached the way Womack claims to have been. Remember, though, that Sue's last name is misspelled in the police paperwork, which took me months to figure out, so even Elliot refers to her here as Sue Daniels.
Yeah, I mean, I think Sue Daniels had the same credibility issues as Joe. You know, that you read her testimony and you're sort of like, none of this makes sense. You know, it just doesn't seem real. There's nothing to verify it. Here's this person with an obvious motive. She's upset at William. She's upset at William because he was, you know, apparently having, you know, relationships with other women. And she wanted to get back at him. And you know, the frustrating part for us about Sue Daniels is that we too couldn't talk to her. You know, that knowing what Wagner and Brandt did with Joe Womack.
He's referring to Newport detectives Norm Wagner and Mark Brandt.
I think should add a cloud to every single statement that implicated William in this case. And I have no idea what they did to Sue Daniels to get her to provide those false statements. But they were false.
Amanda and I kept this idea in mind as we read through hundreds of pages of police documents, including interview transcripts. We found something odd. First, there was a handwritten note that basically described Sue Daniels' testimony that Virgil had approached months earlier asking for help in killing Retha. That wouldn't have struck us as odd, except the name in the document wasn't Sue Daniel. It was Betty Kilo, another of Virgil's female friends. The story is otherwise the same, but the witness is a different woman altogether. As a reminder, we weren't given permission to make photocopies or take pictures of the documents, so we took audio notes instead. Here's us talking.
A handwritten note about Betty Kilo from 4/29/87 at 3:30 p.m. It says, 2 to 3 months ago, asked Betty to help him kill Retha over at McMillan Street Mission. Wanted Betty to strangle her on the street. Told Betty he would love to kill this bitch because she was holding stolen credit cards over his head.
This notation is dated April 29th, 1987 at 3:30 p.m. But this is at odds with the bulk of a transcript we found of an interview with Kilo taken at the same time. In it, Kilo says she had met Retha twice before. She had been to her apartment with Virgil because he asked for a ride to find out why Retha had failed to pick him up one night for church. The rendezvous wasn't confrontational. In fact, Virgil spent a little alone time with Retha in the bedroom while Kilo waited in the kitchen. Retha had a lot of guys in and out of her apartment from what Kilo saw. A lot of the men were convicts on parole staying in halfway homes. The detectives asked Kilo if Virgil had stolen anything while there. Kilo said no, not that she saw. Detective, did he ever talk to you about Retha Welch? Kilo, he said she was someone who, you know, helped him, like since he came home, helped him get his life straightened, and helped him out with the things he needs. She would take him places.
She does just keep reiterating that Retha helped Virgil a lot, and that he talked about. Okay, oh, here's one. Interviewer. So Betty says that she went to the jail to talk to Virgil. Interviewer, did he discuss this with you at all? Betty. Yeah, he did. I asked him if he'd do it. You know, I mean, I don't know why I asked him if he'd do it, because he ain't that type of person, you know? I mean, I don't think he is. I don't know. I don't really know what goes inside a person's mind. Interviewer, did he ever talk to you about wanting to take anything from her? Betty, anytime you talk to him about her, he was always saying she would help him with, you know, she would get him help on the street. Anything he would need, she would help. I think she was even trying to get him a job, you know.
This interview with Kilo lasts a good while. She talks about Virgil like he's all bravado, trying to make himself out like a criminal mastermind when he's nothing more than a petty thief. They had dated a while, but broken up because of another girlfriend. Still, she says, he's not a killer. She could see him snapping and stabbing someone once, but not 20-plus times. At some point, she says she doesn't want to talk smack about him because she's not interested in getting him in trouble.
Interviewer, how much more danger can he be? I mean, he's charged with murder. Betty, but I don't believe it. But like I say, everybody, you know, has got ways about them about getting money. He just had the attitude of to take things. So she doesn't think he did it.
Yeah.
She's pretty adamant about it.
Betty's so adamant, in fact, that it's starting to make sense to me that she wasn't called to testify at trial. Why would prosecutors put her on the stand if she says he wasn't capable of murder? But then something happened.
All right, so in the interview with Betty Kelo, interviewer, did Rita ever accuse him of taking her credit cards? Betty, parentheses, could you turn it off for a second? So they turn off the recorder. Interviewer, the time was 3:55 p.m.
17 minutes later, they turned the recorder back on. Betty said that part of her earlier statement was incorrect.
Interviewer, okay, what part was incorrect? Betty, the part about, him breaking up because of a girlfriend of mine, that was a lie. Interviewer, and what's the truth behind your breaking up with him? Betty, because he asked me to kill the woman Welch. Help him kill her.
Betty's story changed entirely. Virgil said he wanted her to help kill Rita and that he had stolen credit cards from her and was sick of Rita threatening to alert his probation officer. It was a stark about-face.
But it sounds like they coached her through all this at this point, because they turned it off after she had been saying no, she didn't
get it. Pretty adamantly, again and again and again.
And she knew nothing about the credit cards, and then all of a sudden she knows all these details?
Are you kidding me? This happens right after you turn off the...
Right.
The interview concludes soon after. Betty Kelo spent much longer insisting Virgil was innocent than she did positing his guilt. We wanted to know what happened in the 17 minutes that the tape recorder was off. Why had Kelo had such a change of heart? And why, after that change of heart, did she not testify about William Virgil trying to get her to help kill Rita Welch? I found Kelo's phone number and called her up. She hung up on me. I wrote her a letter to explain while I was calling to at least make sure she was hanging up on me with some idea of what I had hoped to talk about. I got a voicemail in response.
Ma'am, I'm gonna ask you again, please contact me through phone, mail, or anything. I truly would fucking appreciate it. Quit fucking bothering me.
So, those 17 minutes remain a mystery.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Virgil was offered a plea deal during his trial, but he refused. He said he couldn't confess to killing Rita, as the plea required, because he didn't do it. The jury sided with prosecutors and then sentenced him to 70 years in prison, twice the time he was offered if he had pleaded. 70 years might sound as though it's a better deal than life behind bars, but nothing in this case has been simple so far, and the sentencing is no different. See, jurors knew that if they sentenced Virgil to life, he would be eligible for parole after 12 years by Kentucky law. So instead, the jury gave him 70, knowing that he would have to serve at least 35 years before being eligible for parole. Virgil's case was specifically cited in a 1991 Inquirer story that explained how life could be the lesser sentence. We've already mentioned a few names of other potential players in this case that deserved scrutiny back in 1987, but there's one that stands out more than the others. It's time to talk about Isaac Grubbs. Grubbs was a petty criminal with a violent streak. I know he had a rap sheet because I've talked with one of his defense lawyers. Patton, the man who defended Virgil in 1987, has records indicating he was Grubbs' public defender twice. He didn't keep detailed notes from the time, but he remembers the man pretty vividly.
Isaac Grubbs, who I had represented at least twice before, once I had to take a truck for a part of my fee, so I knew who the guy was. I knew he was violent because he was always in trouble with the law. And he, when you'd talk to him, he'd, hey, sir, this, and just yap and talk real loud, like he maybe he had a hearing problem, I don't know. But he was not a fun client to sit across from and interview him and stuff.
Grubbs died April 11th, 1987. That's 2 days before Retha Welch's body was found. In trial, prosecutors argued that Retha was killed April 9th, though that estimate is suspect. For starters, a neighbor told police he saw Retha on Saturday, which was April 11th. Second, determining time of death isn't like on TV. I watched an episode of the original Law & Order recently, and an evidence technician at the crime scene spitballed that the victim died at 11 p.m. the night before, give or take an hour. Yeah, that doesn't happen in real life.
It's suspicious that that had been a 3-day dead body. I don't believe it. And they bloat that point, and it was not. It looked pretty damn fresh.
Once, early in my crime reporting career, I came home and excitedly told my boyfriend, guess why a body floats faster in hot water than in cold? I had interviewed a pathologist that day, and we were talking about a woman who had gone missing in Lake St. Clair near Detroit. The pathologist told me that, because the upcoming weekend was supposed to be warm, she would probably surface soon. I asked why. He explained what gases do to bodies and death. The warmer it is, the more bacteria the body hosts, and the bacteria cause gas. Gas makes bodies float. I had been completely bummed to write about this heartbreaking case of a young woman who had drowned in an accident, but I remember finding the science behind what I learned a fascinating distraction. In Retha's death, the time of death was inferred by a few things, one element being that police simply believe she died on Thursday because they believe that's when Virgil stayed with her. It might seem as though coroners should make the time of death estimate without police influence, but that's not how it really works. Additionally, rigor mortis had come and gone, which can take up to 48 hours, though it can happen within 36 hours or just a day and a half. Retha's body was mildly decomposed, but there's no notation of how warm or cool it was in her apartment that day. And that temperature could affect how quickly that process got underway. A sliding glass door in Retha's apartment was open, and according to the almanac, the mean temperature was 50 degrees that day, so a little on the chilly side. Still, none of the police records suggest it was abnormally cold inside the apartment. What Patton said earlier about bloating is right. Usually at the 3-day mark, gases in the body have caused the body to bloat and swell, which is a pretty grotesque sight. So I asked Harold Vick, the coworker who found Retha's body.
Was she like bloated? Like, because the timeline matters in terms of how long she had been in there.
Like I said, she was a big woman to begin with, but I didn't get the idea that she was bloated. So,
okay.
I mean, she was a little puffier than she normally would, but I've seen dead bodies after they've been out for a while, and she wasn't all one like that. It wasn't like that.
And was it really cold in the apartment, or was it normal temperature?
It was normal temperature.
Normal. Okay. All right. All right. That's helpful. Thank you.
Grubbs' death, like Retha's, was big news, but for different reasons. Grubbs had been shot dead on a Newport Street by police officers. Just as in today's climate, officer-involved deaths were big news back then. The three officers involved were put on leave while an investigation was underway, which Police Chief Rick Huck promised would be thorough. The officers were eventually cleared of wrongdoing, but Grubbs' family felt they had been railroaded. Something didn't sit right with them, and Patton remembers that they sued the police department. He also recalls that they got a settlement, but I can't find record of that. Here's what news reports said at the time. 27-year-old Grubbs had gone to his girlfriend's mother's house in the 900 block of Columbia Street. This was less than 3/4 of a mile from Retha's apartment on the same street. Grubbs was supposedly doing mechanical work on a car his girlfriend had bought the day before, and he became irate. The girlfriend's mom called police, and when officers arrived, Grubbs had a knife. He was wild-eyed and lunged at them, and the cops opened fire. Grubbs was shot 4 times, according to the coroner. It's worth noting that the coroner found a 5th bullet inside his body, but that it was far older. Grubbs had apparently known violence in his life. From the time Grubbs arrived to work on the car and the time he died, minutes had passed. The girlfriend's mom told a reporter at the time that police had no choice. She said, quote, "I saw him drawing his hand back like he was going to stab them. They tried to get him to drop the knife, but he wouldn't. He looked real wild-like, real scary," end quote. The woman's daughter, Rachel, is quoted as saying she had lived with Grubbs since October. "If police hadn't killed him," she said, "he would have hurt them." So there's a wild-eyed, knife-wielding criminal gunned down by police near the same time that a woman is killed by knife not 10 blocks away. Law professor Colin Miller.
I don't understand, and maybe you've done more investigation into the case than I have. Is there any indication in the record anywhere as to why he really wasn't pursued by the police?
No, that's weird, right?
Next time on Accused.
And he happened to be a half-brother by a different name to Isaac Grubbs. And he said, yeah, Isaac came up to me and he said, I want you to burn these clothing for me. I've gotten an altercation or something with a lady down at the Yacht and Tennis Club. And he said, I might have killed her.
This is a special project by the Cincinnati Enquirer and Cincinnati.com, reported and narrated by Amber Hunt, edited by Amy Wilson, produced by Amanda Rossman and Phil Didion. Music was composed by Andrew Higley. Kimberly Armstrong assisted with research. For photos, documents, and more, go to accusedpodcast.com.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.